This is News in Notes. I'm Tony Cox in for Farah Chidea. On today's roundtable, U.S. Marines now face murder charges for the Haditha massacre. And one 60-something writer asks this question: do senior citizens really need all those discounts? We'll talk about that and a lot more. Joining us now is Joe Davidson, an editor for The Washington Post, Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University and a columnist for the Winston-Salem Journal in Columbia, South Carolina. Hello, everybody. How are you today?
Hello, Tony.
Hey, Tony.
Let's start with the Haditha massacre. After an investigation that has lasted over a year, a Marine Corps squad leader was charged with killing 12 civilians in the alleged massacre. That's the Iraqi town, of course, where 24 civilians were killed in November 2005. Now, the 26-year-old squad leader allegedly commanded his troops to, quote, shoot first and ask questions later. A total of 8 Marines now face charges in what is being called the biggest U.S. criminal case involving killings to come out of the war in Iraq. And Colonel Stuart Navarre of Camp Pendleton addressed the media yesterday regarding the charges.
All Marines are trained in and are expected to fully comply with the law of armed conflict. The Marine Corps takes allegations of wrongdoing by Marines very seriously and is committed to thoroughly investigating such allegations. The Marine Corps also prides itself on holding its members accountable for their actions.
Now, Colonel Navarre went on to say this incident does no one any good.
As you know, sir, the Marine Corps is a close-knit brotherhood, so it is difficult for any Marine to countenance the fact that other Marines might have done something wrong.
So, Mary Frances, let me come to you first. What do you think the ripple effects for the Marines and other military, other arms of the military, might be as a result of this?
Well, I think there may be a ripple effect, but what concerns me more about this is that we know that professionals who are under stress, whether they're police officers in the Sean Bell shooting in New York or the Diallo shooting, or whether they are people under even greater stress over there in Iraq, that they are sometimes very afraid, that they respond to things quickly while they're in the field, and because they're scared. And we can say, well, they shouldn't be scared, but if we were there, we would be scared too. And when somebody gets blown up in front of you and you know that there are people being blown up, it's a tragedy that those people got killed, but I can understand why they would do that no matter how much training that they have. In part, it's the responsibility of the people who put them there in this war that Mr. Bush and Condi Rice says is worth the investment and the continued stress. There'll be more incidents. There have been more before if we don't stop it. I also think that the worst part of it is the killing, but then there's the cover-up. The senior officers who find out about this and then try to pretend like it didn't happen or characterize it as something else, that sends a bad signal down up the chain of command. They should have just fessed up. In this day and age, there's always a video somewhere. There are always witnesses somewhere. So I think it may have a ripple effect, but I think as long as this war goes on the way it is, with the stress that is there, you can expect other people operating under stress to behave in ways that they shouldn't behave.
Well, let me bring Joe in on this. Joe, what do you think? Is the effect of the actions, the alleged actions of the officers, is that worse than, in some senses, let me not suggest that the killing is not bad, but is that in some ways a worse offense than the actual killing, do you think?
Well, you know, the Marine Corps spokesman spoke about the close-knit brotherhood in the clip you just played, and I think that cuts both ways. I think that that close-knit brotherhood certainly allows Marines to look out for each other, to care for each other, and to have each other's back in some very important ways. But I think having each other's back can lead to the kind of cover-up that's being charged in this case. And I think you do see that in police forces as well. Mary mentioned the two killings by police officers in New York of unarmed civilians, and certainly in the Amadou Diallo case in 1999, here was a situation where this person wasn't even armed. Of the more recent case with Sean Bell, he wasn't armed either. But people began firing. After one person fired, there was an onslaught of fire. And in the case in Iraq, you have a situation where Marines went into houses, cleared houses with grenades and gunfire against unarmed civilians. And so that's now resulting in these these charges. So I think the cover-up to these kinds of things sends the wrong kind of message about the close-knit brotherhood, if in fact it was a cover-up, because I'm not trying to convict these people before they go to trial.
I understand.
But if there was a cover-up, then that close-knit brotherhood, I think, becomes a bit too close-knit to the detriment not only of the people who were killed, but also to the reputation of the Marine Corps and the U.S. Armed Forces in general.
Well, you know, Nat Irvin, when you hear the word massacre with regard to American forces involved in war, for me at least, and I'm sure for some others who are old enough to remember, the name My Lai comes to mind, although that was a very different situation in Vietnam. From the standpoint that these Marines saw one of their own killed and reacted, whether it was appropriate or inappropriate is still to be decided. But my question to you is, this doesn't rise to the level of the My Lai massacre in your mind, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I think you just nailed it right on the head, Tony, because what this reflects, I think, is if you look at the public's attitude toward Iraq and then the Marines, we're very sympathetic. We're very opposed to this war, but we are very sympathetic with the Marines, the other soldiers who are sacrificing every day, families who are sacrificing, bearing the burden for us being over in Iraq in the first place. The second thing is being in a place where, you know, we see every day, or we question, why are we there? If we think about the troops being there, and we think about the Iraqis who seem to be ungrateful, then we think about the great tragedy of 24 people being killed. But, you know, I think the key thing for me, at least, is to think about this, not to confuse the actions of a few Marines whose actions clearly, as it looks now, certainly not premeditated murder, but unpremeditated murder is what they're being charged with. But we don't want to, I don't think, confuse the actions of the military with the policy that has gotten us to the mess in the first place. I think that's where most Americans are. And as we think about, you know, the larger context of how the military looks, the military obviously has to be very aggressive in how it pursues the charges against these troops, because the military has to think long term. It has to think about the next war. Mm-hmm. And as Joe was talking about the close-knit brotherhood, that's very important. But you have to have military cohesion within the unit, discipline. And this doesn't reflect very well in this instance on our
own. Tony, before you move on, I think you do have to connect the policy with the actions of the military. The longer it goes on, the more stress that's placed on troops, the longer they're in this environment, which we all know and has been documented in the Iraq Study Group and everywhere else and in the media, that goes on, this supercharged, tensed atmosphere where people are getting blown up all the time, the more likely that military people who are put on tours of duty over and over again and stressed out will be trigger happy, mm-hmm. and do things that they themselves would be embarrassed about later and end up to the detriment of the civilians who are over there. So the policy and decisions about how long you keep it going and how long you keep the troops there and the circumstances you put them under means that you're putting the civilians at risk and you're putting the troops at risk.
That's an interesting point. Let's go on to another thing, but before we do that, if you're just joining us, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox, sitting in for Farai Chidea today. Joe Davidson is joining us. He's an editor with the Washington Post. Mary Frances Berry, a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Nat Irvin, professor of future studies at Wake Forest University. Topic number two for today, Darfur. Now, the U.S. is demanding that the Sudanese government allow a team of U.N. personnel into Darfur and accept peacekeeping efforts by the end of the year or face the consequences. So, Joe, is this an empty threat?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the Bush administration is really under some significant public pressure. You see full-page newspaper ads calling on Bush to take more aggressive action to stem the genocide in Darfur. Now, it's interesting that President Bush calls this, the United States government calls this a genocide, which is a term that many other nations around the world have been reluctant to use. But beyond that rhetoric, beyond that policy statement, many people want the Bush administration to be the driving force for the United Nations to take more aggressive action in terms of a multinational force to go into the area to stop this genocide. That doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon, and the United States has not specified what kinds of actions it will take to help stem this action, even though the Bush administration official, Mr. Nastasios, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing his name, just was there to indicate that the United States would do something. So just what that something is going to be remains unknown, so it's hard to say whether it's an empty threat or not.
What's not clear to me, Nat Irvin, is why now? Why make the threat now?
Well, gosh, Tony, you know, I was looking back over where this administration has been on the situation in Sudan, and, you know, it's kind of hard to believe that actually we were on the right course. The Bush administration had charged then Secretary of State Powell to really get involved in the situation. As recently as January of 2005, Powell was in Kenya signing a agreement between the two part rival factions in the Sudan. I was looking forward to bringing an end to what had been called genocide. But now here we are at the end of 2006. And you can see how weakened we are as a country, the United States and the United Nations, in trying to actually resolve this crisis. In fact, even last month, it looked like the Sudanese government had agreed to accept the recommendations for the UN Council for this troops and for aid. And the threat, what the United States is going to do, what the UN is going to do with its possibly a no-fly zone and probably some economic sanctions, remains to be seen. But it just really illustrates how badly distracted the entire world is, in my opinion, by what's happening in the Middle East and with Iraq.
Well, Mary Frances, I'm in a little bit of a dilemma now because I wanted to go to another topic, and I wanted to come to you. But I learned from my mama that this wasn't a good thing because we're going to be talking about senior discounts. And so I'm not going to come to you first to talk about senior discounts. I'm going to go I'm going to go to Joe Davidson because
go right ahead. If you let me say about Sudan that I'm happy that anything is happening, even if it's nothing, it's more than was happening before, which was nothing.
Oh, thank you for letting me off the hook on that one. Listen,
and let me say that Mary's young at any age.
Well, you know that's right. Alan Sloan, a Newsweek Wall Street editor, says that, you know what, he doesn't think that it's such a good idea for senior citizens to be getting all of these discounts. And as somebody who has been looking forward, I have a little ways to go, but still looking forward to getting my discounts because I think that I have earned them. How do you feel about that, Joe Davidson? Sloan's point is that seniors are not as broke as we seem to think they are, and they don't really need to be entitled to all of these financial discounts.
Well, you know, it's true that if you look at the senior citizens in the United States as a whole, many of them, well, let's say not as a whole, but certainly many of them are relatively well off compared to other segments of society. But it's also true that there are many who are stuck on a fixed income, Social Security perhaps, and that's all or little more. And it can be very difficult for them to get around on public transportation or anything else given the limited size of their income. And so, you know, perhaps it would make more sense if we could somehow means test such things as reduced fares on public transit. But that can get very complicated and messy as it is in other areas of public services. And so while I certainly agree there are many people such as Mr. Sloan who probably don't need those discounts, if we took those away from those who don't need them, we would also run the risk of taking them away from those people who certainly do need them.
So what do you say, Mary Frances Berry, when you do get to become a senior citizen one day, way down the line, how would you feel about these discounts?
Well, I think that giving discounts is one way to accord some respect to seniors in a culture where youth is everything, and unlike some other countries, once people get to be seniors, we don't pay that much attention to giving respect to them that they are due. But I also think Joe is right on target when he says that people who don't afford them should give them. Seniors vote. That's the other reason. Children don't. Poor children don't, which is the other reason why you don't just divert some subsidy from seniors and give it to poor children, which is what I would do. But I also think that what we ought to do is keep the discounts, but say, send out a clear message to people who don't need them, don't take them.
Mm-hmm.
Make it a matter of pride that if you don't need it, you don't take it.
That's interesting. What do you think about that, Nat?
Oh, I love that. I don't think it'll work. However,
greed is good.
Greed is good. I mean, and plus, companies, when you look at the statistics, the demographic future of this country over the next 15 years, the number of people over the age of 50 is going to grow by 74%, while the number of people under the age of 50 is only going to grow by roughly 1%. So in other words, we're getting ready to be very gray. We're getting ready to be in a point where 20% of the entire population will be over the age of 65. So in terms of a company standpoint, this is big business. This is great marketing. And what it means to be a senior, I think, is dramatically going to change. And really, you're just talking about how people perceive themselves more than anything else. Companies are just going to take advantage of the fact that they have a market of people who are over a certain age and who, you know, hey, here's a discount, come and buy from me.
Absolutely. One thing we could do, Tony, is move up the age.
To
you
what?
Know, not
to
65, but now, given how long people live, keep moving up the age.
I've been waiting for my discount, Mary. We do that, I'm going to have to wait a lot longer. Listen, we only got about a minute left, and because this is our last show before Christmas on Monday, I wanted to give you all just a very brief opportunity to say, what do you do on Christmas? What do you do on Christmas morning? Joe, what do you do, really briefly?
Well, I'll wake up. I'll probably go for a run since it's a day off, and I won't have to worry about cutting the run short. And then I'll come back and greet my son, who's in from Houston, where he now lives. So I don't get to see him quite as often as I used to. And we'll probably open some presents that day and have a very nice meal. So all should be good. I have another son coming in from Philadelphia and one in Newark, Delaware, who unfortunately I won't see till later in the week, but it'll be a good family holiday.
That's nice. He took up some of your time, Nat, about 10 seconds for you. What are you going to do on that
well,
day?
Well, after we've been to church, of course, we're going to go to Uncle Marvin's house where Aunt Ruth cooks dinner, and then at some point in the afternoon and the evening, all of the family gets together and start singing. And somebody's going to start singing Jesus, Oh, What a Wonderful Child, and then all of a sudden the family's going to break out and doing the electric slide. Man, and my father, the Baptist preacher, is going to wake up and say, what's going on here?
Man, they really took all the time. Mary Frances Berry, I've got
Katrina,
5 seconds for you to say.
I go to New Orleans, and I work on the aftermath of Katrina, trying to help somebody, which is what Christmas should be all about anyway.
Everybody, have a very happy holiday, and thanks for being with us.
The same to you.
Thank you. Same to you.